From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Pentagon, the U.S. military, is the planet's biggest consumer of fossil fuels. Aircraft carriers, battle tanks, Humvees, fighter jets, air conditioners in Kandahar, oil guzzlers, all. So when the price per barrel rises, it hits the military hard. And then there's the issue of secure supplies. Pentagon strategists have long determined that for national security, draining the force is the way to go. But Congress is now saying no. Not a penny more for alternative fuels. Too expensive. Stick with fossil fuels. This hour on Point, Congress says no to the Pentagon's move to green. You can join the conversation. Should the U.S. military be investing in a green future? Is that national security? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later this hour, we'll hear a high school English teacher's blunt declaration to the graduating class of 2012. You are not special. But first, to the Pentagon and fuel supplies, energy supplies, and Congress saying no. Here's a little sound from last fall. This was at a Blue Angel, you know, the fancy flying jets show at a Naval Air Station outside Washington, D.C. Secretary of the Navy, Ray Mabus, announced that the demonstration squadron's planes had been certified to fly with a 50-50 jet fuel biofuel mix. He said there the greening of the Navy was in the national interest.
We're doing this for one reason. There are a lot of side benefits, but the main reason we're moving toward alternative energy in the Navy and Marine Corps is to make us better warfighters, is to reduce our vulnerability on imported fossil fuel, to make sure that we have energy security and energy independence in the United States military, United States Navy, United States Marine Corps.
Energy security, energy independence, alternative fuels, there, U.S. Secretary of the Navy, Ray Mabus. But here was a hearing, Senate Armed Services Committee in March. Arizona Senator Republican John McCain told Ray Mabus that the Pentagon had no business getting into the green energy business.
I don't believe it's the job of the Navy to be involved in building and involved in new technologies. Maybe this will be a Solyndra situation. I don't believe that it's the job of the United States Navy to do that. I believe it's the Energy Department.
Let's see what's going on. Joining me first today on Congress and the Pentagon's energy future is Noah Schachtman. He's a contributing editor at Wired Magazine, editor of its national security blog, Danger Room. Joins us from New York. Noah Schachtman, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
So what's going on here? First, with the Pentagon interest in alternative fuels, and then with the pushback from Congress.
Well, let's actually start with the pushback from Congress. That clip you gave from John McCain is actually kind of bizarre, because the Navy actually has pioneered different forms of fuel for the last couple of hundred years. They were big in the push to nuclear power. They're big in the push from coal to oil, and they're big on the push from sales to coal.
Yeah.
So going all the way back, the Navy's actually been a real pioneer and a real kickstarter when it comes to alternative fuels. Now you can argue that the alternative fuels that they're using may not be the right ones, and that their alternative energy strategy may not be perfect, but the idea that the Navy shouldn't be involved in new fuel technology, that's just not true.
So the U.S. military has been pushing what when it comes to alternative fuel? I mean, we've seen the reports about the little solar arrays in Afghanistan where they're having a heck of a time getting oil in from Pakistan. But the bigger thing is biofuels, right? Biofuels that we saw out there with the Blue Angels, I guess that would be for fighter jets eventually, for ships. But the biofuel push was the biggest?
Right. So overall in the Defense Department, there's a big push underway to get fuel consumption under control. And so that means a mixture of solar, biofuels, wind, and just plain old conservation. So the Navy, for example, is really for the first time putting mission planning computers on some of its ships that allow it to sail along with the waves and save fuel rather than directly into a wave and waste fuel.
Mm-hmm.
Just little things like that can really add up. The big controversy, though, is around biofuels. Why? Two reasons. Number one, these biofuels are very expensive at the moment, about four times the price of petroleum. Number two, biofuels are risky. There's a big chance that biofuel technologies, as currently configured, won't work out. And there's even a chance that the current biofuels being used aren't really that good for the environment, that it might actually take more it might produce more greenhouse gases or almost as much greenhouse gases to collect and produce these biofuels as it does for petroleum.
Are we talking corn ethanol or something else here? I've seen a lot of algae talk in the Navy's push.
Yeah. There's not no corn ethanol is not on the on the Navy's radar at all. But there's a lot of other things that are. There has been some. They've bought some algae fuel. They bought a bunch of fuel made from mustard seeds. And their biggest purchase is actually, and this is going to sound weird, it's actually from a division of Tyson Foods, the chicken processor, and it's a whole bunch of waste chicken grease that they're going to fly some jets on.
They're talking about sending out a green armada, what was it, this summer, next summer, sometime soon?
Yeah, they've purchased 450,000 gallons of biofuel that they're going to use to have an entire aircraft carrier group sail for a couple of days on this stuff. An aircraft carrier group is important because it's really the symbol of American power. There's only 11 functional, full-blown aircraft carriers in the world right now. America has 10 of them. And whenever there's a big trouble going on in the world,
sure,
America dispatches an aircraft carrier to it. So to have an aircraft carrier group, the aircraft carrier, its jets, the destroyers, the all the accompanying ships, doing something green is a pretty potent symbol.
So it's a symbol, but they're saying it's important, too. I mean, that 450,000 gallons, I think I read, was the biggest single purchase of biofuels in the history of the industry.
Biggest military purchase, yeah. And the so that's just a two-day sale. In a couple of years, the Navy's planning on sending out this great green fleet for a month. But it won't be able to do so if Congress has its way. Both the House and Senate Armed Services Committee have basically passed amendments to the Pentagon budget that would essentially kill the Navy's biofuel program.
So this is buried in that huge defense budget. Of course, oil, fossil fuels, energy, a huge part of that budget itself, and one that went way over budget in the last year or two. So what's Congress saying? Exactly how are they stopping the Pentagon's green push?
They're basically saying that you can't buy any alternative fuel that costs more than petroleum. And the reason that kills biofuels is because, look, right now there's only very small quantities of biofuels made. 450,000 gallons may sound like a lot, but it's only powering the ship, powering this one aircraft carrier group for 2 days. They've got 11 aircraft carrier groups to power for 365 days. So as you can imagine, that 450,000 gallons is kind of a drop in the bucket. So it's not surprising that with a small amount purchased and with a relatively unproven technology that it's going to cost a lot. There's no way to bring that cost down unless you buy more of it and continue to develop the technology.
Here's the Virginia Republican Representative Randy Forbes, Noah. He was taking on the Navy Secretary Ray Mabus over the cost of alternative energy at a time when dollars are tight.
It's a matter of priorities. I look at all the cuts we're making, not in alternative energy, they're going up. I look again at your priorities. Third top priority you have is to have the Navy lead the nation in sustainable energy. You're not the Secretary of the Energy, you're the Secretary of the Navy.
Well, that's a spanking. You're not the Secretary of Energy or the Secretary of the Navy. What is motivating the pushback from Congress? I mean, as you say, it costs more than conventional fossil fuel, but the Navy's looking down the road and saying if we establish a market for this, we can bring these prices down. We need it for national security. Is this really about fiscal responsibility, or what's going on here, Noah?
Well, I think it's a little bit about fiscal responsibility, but we're only talking about $12 million out of a Pentagon budget that's around $600 billion. So it's teeny tiny. I think what's going on here is two things. Number one, all green energy programs have sort of become political in the wake of Solyndra and other scandals.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, Ray Mabus, the Secretary of the Navy,
and former U.S. Ambassador to Saudi Arabia, so he knows something about energy country.
Yeah, but he's also the former governor of Mississippi, mm-hmm. and he's taken a very political approach to being Navy Secretary. He's sort of taken politics, he's sort of brought politics into a job that's usually considered somewhat apolitical. So, for example, he recently named a ship after Representative Gabrielle Giffords, mm-hmm. the Democratic congresswoman who was shot in the head. Mm-hmm. Don't usually name ships after living people. He recently, on Cinco de Mayo, christened a ship the USS Cesar Chavez.
But is he alone in the Pentagon, Noah, in wanting the U.S. military to have alternatives to fossil fuel?
Absolutely not. And I honestly don't think there's any debate over whether there should be alternatives to fossil fuel.
Well, but this move by Congress has cut off that effort.
Well, it's cut off one of the efforts, right? It's cut off one of the efforts.
Isn't it the biggest effort, the biofuel push? Isn't that the largest one?
I don't know if it's the largest one. I think it's got the most potential payoff down the road. I think that it's got a lot of symbolic import with this great green fleet sailing right now.
But they didn't say you can't buy any you can't buy any biofuels. They said you can't buy anything that costs more than fossil fuels, which is just about every alternative fuel at this point, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. No, it's right. What I'd say is that they've been less hostile to solar and wind and energy conservation efforts. But, you know, look, at the base of this, this is about politics. This is not about energy policy.
Well, the Pentagon says we need this for the future of national security. Congress saying not a penny more than for oil for that. Noah Schachmann, thanks for the briefing. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Congress telling the U.S. military not to go green. When the military says it's time to go, time to move to alternative fuels, Congress takes a stand essentially for fossil fuels, or for fiscal responsibility, not to spend more on alternative fuels than on oil. Here's a little bit more of Naval Secretary Ray Mabus. This was a March 15th Senate Armed Services Committee meeting. He's telling lawmakers here that rising fuel costs mean less money for other things during naval and marine operations.
Every time the cost of a barrel of oil goes up a dollar, it costs the Department of the Navy $31 million in extra fuel cost. These price spikes have to be paid for out of our operational funds. That means that our sailors and Marines are forced to steam less, fly less, and train less.
An operational argument there and a national security argument. The Secretary is saying we can't afford not to do this.
We cannot afford not to do this. We can't afford to be dependent on foreign sources of fuel. We cannot afford to be dependent on a worldwide commodity that has the price spikes and the price shocks that we have.
There, the Naval Secretary, Republicans, and some coal state Democrats saying no, no to all that. We're looking at it. With us now from Washington is Phyllis Cutnow, Director of the Pew Center's Clean Energy Program and the Pew Project on National Security, Energy, and Climate. Phyllis Cutnow, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Thanks, Tom, for having me.
And with us from the Cato Institute, Vice President for Defense and Foreign Policy Studies, retired Naval Officer Christopher Preble. Christopher Preble, welcome to you.
Hello, Tom.
Phyllis, first to you, how important has the Pentagon's push for alternative fuels been?
Well, I think it's been critically important. And I think the facts are clear about why they're doing it. This is to, you know, particularly around advanced biofuels and efficiency, it is to save the lives of American warfighters and save taxpayer dollars. They're doing a lot on efficiency, and that's about saving warfighters' mm-hmm. lives. But when it comes to advanced biofuels, this is really about mitigating risk to the Pentagon budget in the future. And the facts are really clear here. If you just look back, in 2005, the Pentagon acquired 130 million barrels of oil for $8.8 billion.
Mm-hmm.
In 2008, they bought 134 million barrels of oil for $17.9 billion. So the cost more than doubled. From 2009 to 2010, costs went up 19% despite the fact that consumption went down by 9%. And so, you know, you heard Ray Mabus in your clip talk mm-hmm. about cost, the budget, and where that money comes from. Over the last 2 years alone, they've had $5.6 billion in unanticipated fuel costs.
Fair enough, but Republican congressmen and others say, yes, but your alternative fuels cost even more, and we can't afford that now.
Well, I think this is about an investment today for payoff tomorrow. And, you know, the Department of Defense rightly has been a real technology innovator. If you look at, you know, things we use every day and things we don't use every day. For instance, the internet, GPS, night vision goggles, mm-hmm. to kind of all kinds of new operational platforms. So they have been an innovator, and frankly, I would say they are one of the best at it. So it is a matter of investing today to bring down costs quickly so that we can really use this. And remember, the Department of Defense is about mitigating risk. This is what they want to do, protect their budget into the future, because we know that gasoline is going to continue to spike. And your listeners, you know, they go every week to fill up their cars. Mm-hmm. They know what an impact it has when prices go up. And so when you imagine that you are the largest consumer of liquid fuels in the world, you know, something has got to be done here that is besides efficiency.
Christopher Preble, we've heard the pushback here from Republicans and some Democrats, a few, on this. We heard the strong support for it, Leon Panetta and the Navy Secretary and others in the military. A couple of years ago, New York Times columnist Tom Friedman was writing about this. You know, it's the most exciting development, even if the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq don't turn out well, if the military, through this period of time, pushes forward on the green energy front, that may be a great net gain for the whole country. What do you think about the debate that's been in Congress? What's going on here, Christopher?
Well, I think what's mainly going on here is a decision by some in the Pentagon. I'm not entirely convinced that it's mainly uniformed personnel in the Pentagon. A decision to fund companies and industry that is not competitive.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we're talking about here is a massive subsidy from U.S. taxpayers to companies that may or may not ever be able to deliver fuel to the military competitive to petroleum-based fuels.
Isn't that what the Pentagon has done throughout history to put the United States in a position, well, with nuclear power, with the space investments and so on?
Sure. Let me address that. Mm-hmm. When the United States Navy shifted from sail to coal and then from coal to fuel and then ultimately from petroleum fuel in a few cases to nuclear power, which, of course, the nuclear aircraft carriers and the submarines are powered by nuclear power. When they made those decisions, it was not primarily to advantage a industry in the United States at the expense of the U.S. taxpayer. They made that decision because those fuels were best for the Navy. They were the right thing to do in a strictly military sense. In that respect, I think that the efficiency push that the Navy and other and the other services are engaged in makes an enormous amount of sense. The logistics train to supply our troops in the field with fuel and food and water is a vulnerability that our enemies have exploited and will exploit in the future. And therefore, reducing the consumption of those things it makes sense from a national security perspective.
Why wouldn't the alternative fuels make sense as well? And we can see what
The alternative fuels will still be delivered. Biofuels would still be delivered to those troops in the field the same way that other liquid fuels are today. And yet,
convoys.
They are 4 to 5 times as expensive now. And even industry insiders, these are people who are benefiting from this program, who are receiving taxpayer money to fund their private investments and therefore their private gain if they ever turn a profit, admit that their product may never be competitive with petroleum-based fuels. And so we're left with the possibility, and I think, frankly, the likelihood, that U.S. taxpayers will be on the hook to fund in perpetuity an industry that is never competitive. And if you have a question about that, look at the way that we have funded the ethanol program over many, many years to the tune of a great expense to American taxpayers, the dislocation of resources and poor land use decisions in the agricultural sector to the benefit of a very small number of companies. It's the kind of crony capitalism that drives Americans over the wall, and I think with good reason.
Crony capitalism.
Tom?
Phyllis Cutnow, big subsidy or national security here, or both?
Well, let's be clear about a couple of things. One is that we are not going to be shipping advanced biofuels to the battlefield. This is really about using
advanced
biofuels.
Isn't that the vision down the road, though?
Down the road. But in the short term, we're not going to be doing that. We're going to be using them for you know, our domestic supply. That's quite clear. And, you know, when we talk about, kind of a huge subsidy, what we're really talking about here in terms of biorefineries is $70 billion in the request this year for a budget that is more than $670 million. In a, million in a budget that is $640 billion to cost competitiveness. If you look at Bloomberg New Energy Finance, which is the kind of premier clean energy analysis data firm, they predict that the industry will be cost competitive by 2018 because, in reality, the Department of Defense is not going to be the only consumer. So, for instance, the airlines are also testing these fuels and are going to be or would like to be in the future another adopter. And so it isn't as if the Department of Defense is going to be the only consumer, and so costs can be driven down. But in the short term, should America invest, should the Department of Defense invest in these alternative biofuels in a small way to mitigate against big, big risks in the future? Absolutely. I mean, we've just seen from the figures that I quoted, I mean, costs are going up, and we can't afford to allow those costs to go up. I mean, is $70 million in the short term worth it to mitigate against risks like $5.6 billion in unanticipated fuel costs that comes out of the operational budget of the Department of Defense?
We hear your answer. Your answer there is yes. Let's go to our callers, Mike in Clarksville, Tennessee. Mike, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Pretty good. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm just speaking from experience. I retired from the Army, and a lot of those unexpected fuel usages, it's unavoidable. It's just like before, the front soldiers that have to use fuel literally to help burn their waste. I just don't understand how it's taken this long for the military to realize how dependent we are on other countries for our energy, as technologically dependent as we are. I mean, we have rogue states that have nuclear weapons. All they have to do is just destroy the fuel supplies, you know, the major fuel supplies that we use, and then what's going to happen?
So you were Army. Would you support the alternative fuel push or not?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It only makes sense. It only makes sense. We're so dependent on fuel that, I mean, what are they going to do eventually? If worse came to worse, it would be the civilians that would suffer because the military's got to keep going.
Yeah, Mike, we've got it. And we've heard that kind of argument from the military itself. Let me get one more. Anita in Rochester, New York. Anita, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I totally agree with that last gentleman. And I just wanted to say that it's a no-brainer, really, why coal state Democrats and other Republicans and the representative, obviously from the great state of Virginia, a.k.a. coal state, would want to push back against something like this. Their donors are giving them money so that they can speak well of these ancient and archaic systems of fuel. You know, all the fracking that's going on to get the, get the coal out and all of that, and the oil consumption. The military wants to move forward with something more modern, something that makes sense, something sustainable, and something that won't just fuel our enemies and, you know, pigeonhole us into bad situations.
Anita, we've got it. And I guess you're on the go for the green here as well. Let me bring another voice in, if I may, from Washington. Dennis McGinn joins us, retired Navy Vice Admiral, 35-year naval career, was Deputy Chief of Naval Operations for Warfare Requirements and Programs at the Pentagon. He has headed up whole fleets. Admiral McGinn, thanks very much for being with us.
Great to be with you, Tom.
Okay, you've got a big military background. You're also now in the renewable energy, support the American Council on Renewable Energy nonprofit. How do you look at the debate that's going on in Congress?
It's all about military requirements. It's unfortunate that politics has reared its ugly head in this discussion, but I've talked to many, many people in uniform and civilian leadership. And this is all about improving the warfighting effectiveness and the taxpayers' bottom line in terms of our national security.
How does biofuel do that, or alternative fuels down the road?
By starting to displace our almost singular reliance, over-reliance on fossil fuel, in this case petroleum, with all of the uncertainty about prices in the past and certainly going forward in the future, the divergence of supply and demand when you see economies like China and India rising, it's going to be more and more expensive over time. And the military is very, very good at looking over the horizon beyond the next business cycle, beyond the next election cycle, and saying, this is the security environment that we need to be prepared to fight and win in the future, and we need to make these investments now. And I think that it really, really is an investment in military capability going forward.
What about Christopher Preble says this is, you know, big subsidies, crony capitalism.
Well, I think that's a great phrase if you're a politician. And this isn't about politics. It isn't. I would say that if Christopher were around 60 years ago and we're having this discussion about the Navy's development of nuclear power, he probably would have said it's crony capitalism, which, oh, by the way, we have an industry that supplies 20% of our total electricity in the United States called nuclear power. That's a direct result of some of those Department of Defense, Department of Navy's investments. I think we need to get beyond the clinging to the business as usual and recognize that the world is changing, that we have to adapt to change, that the military is very, very good at doing that for strategic, operational, and tactical reasons, and we need to give them our full support.
Sam in Chelsea, Massachusetts. Sam, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
My question is, I wonder, this discussion in some degree reminds me of discussions amongst the accountants who are cooking the books. And what I mean by that is no one is talking about the environmental consequences and direct dollar costs of burning fossil fuels. So I would ask all the guests to address the real cost, not just the costs at the pump, but the real cost in terms of disease, degradation to the environment, and the end of mankind as we know it.
We'll pick it up. Dennis McGinn. Thank you, Sam.
Sure.
Dennis McGinn, what about is that a national security issue? Does the Pentagon factor that in?
Tom, you bet it is. Our energy security, economic security, and environmental security, locally, regionally, and globally, are all inextricably linked. And we've got to be very mindful. If we try to address something to improve our energy security, we've got to be mindful of the costs that are exacerbated in the environmental sphere. For example, in 2007, the CNA Military Advisory Board, a group of retired 3- and 4-star admirals, put out a report called Climate Change and a Threat to National Security that discussed the dangers to America and to our men and women in uniform as severe weather increased in frequency and severity around the world, and we would be dealing with the effects of this changing global climate. Additionally, when we think about the true social costs of our dependence on fossil fuel, I've seen very, very credible analysis from 3 years ago that said we are actually the cost for America's gasoline at the pump is double what we are actually paying today, because if you factor in some of those health costs and, importantly, a portion of the costs that we taxpayers are funding for our troops to be deployed mm-hmm. around the world at levels of tens of thousands operating hundreds of billions worth of equipment to protect the lifeblood of the world economy,
Fossil fuels right now. Christopher Preble, what about that? Who's got the eye on the real long-term national security here? The Pentagon thinking about the environment or Congress thinking about the pocketbook?
Well, I'm speaking just for myself, but I'm also familiar with the economic literature on energy markets that shows definitively on with respect to the environmental effects of biofuels like corn-based ethanol, which, of course, the Navy's not primarily using. Mm-hmm. But corn-based ethanol was also supposed to save us. Reduce greenhouse gas emissions and other airborne pollutants, and the reality is that the total production cycle of corn-based ethanol has had the opposite effect. It probably is a net same amount of emissions as petroleum-based fuel. But I think there's a more fundamental misconception here, and I hear it so often it needs to be stated. We are dependent upon sources of foreign oil. Where exactly are those sources of foreign oil? Well, most of the oil the United States consumes, of course, comes from the Western Hemisphere. Comes from places like Canada and Mexico. Are we concerned about our dependence upon Canadian and Mexican oil? I don't think so.
Hey, but there's a reason we've got a fleet, you know, around the Persian Gulf, and we all know
reason.
That as well.
It's the wrong reason.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Congress telling the U.S. military not to go green when the military says it's time to go, time to move to alternative fuels. Congress takes a stand for fossil fuels, or not a penny more on alternative fuels than what is being spent for fossil fuels. Now, that's been high. Alternative fuels costs still higher. Military says down the road, we need it. Retired Vice Navy Admiral Dennis McGinn joins us from Washington. Phyllis Cutnow from the Pew Clean Energy Program there, the Project on National Security, Energy, and Climate. And Christopher Preble from the Cato Institute. Here's Congressman, Virginia Republican Congressman Randy Forbes going head-to-head with Ray Mabus at that at a subcommittee meeting on February 17th, saying, look, you're not in this to save lives. You're in this to establish a market for biofuel.
You spent $12 million on 450,000 gallons of fermented algae biofuel, and here's your statement. Not that it's going to save lives of our sailors. You said because the Navy's going to once again lead by helping to establish a market for biofuels.
The Navy Secretary saying the next month, well, yes, we want to do that, and here's why.
The military brings a market here that that the cost of biofuels will be competitive with existing fossil fuels.
And the Secretary Mabus, Navy Secretary, saying, well, you know, the military's done it before with products that have helped the whole country.
So we can bring a market, and we've shown that. We've shown it in things like the Internet, GPS, flat-screen TVs, that all started out with purely military applications and then migrated.
In green energy, not today, Congress is saying right now, and they're blocking this in the big Pentagon spending bill that's going through. Joby in San Francisco is calling. Joby, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Greetings, Tom.
Hi.
You know, I've got a question for Mr. Preble. It just, you know, I hear his outrage about subsidies for an embryonic type of fuel that we're trying to get to create true independence, yet I hear no outrage about the massive subsidies given to an outrageously profitable industry.
Big oil.
I'm opposed
Correct.
To all subsidies.
And the reason being is that, you know, we've got, you know, this feels like is it feels like there's a massive push from big oil behind all these congresspersons and other industry or lobbyists that are helping to try and keep any type of move away from big oil to get off the table so that more wealth can be extracted from, you know, the country, the world, the minerals, instead of actually focusing on true independence.
Joby, we've got it. Christopher Preble, what about it? The big oil subsidies are all over the place. Are you guys fighting those?
Yes, we are.
How's your success so far? I mean, every time that comes up, the subsidies stand right there. They don't go away.
Right, and the subsidies are higher to other alternative fuels still than they are to oil. Look,
oh come on!
You don't solve this problem. You don't solve this problem by increasing subsidies in other industries. You solve the problem if that's the main concern that people have, and I think it's a legitimate concern. And then you reduce the subsidies to oil producers. I'm not here to argue for increasing subsidies anywhere. I want to reduce subsidies. The point here is about this notion of energy independence is a fundamental fallacy, and many people believe it. It's just simply wrong. The people who are dependent upon producing oil into the world market are the ones who are vulnerable, who are most dependent upon that oil reaching the market, not consumers of oil. And we have convinced ourselves of our own vulnerability. And it's a fundamental misconception.
You mean we'll always have full and sufficient access to oil? So there's one issue. But what about the climate consequences of using all that oil? If the Pentagon says, you know, there's also, and we heard Secretary Panetta saying this. I mean,
I've
he's saying down the road, you've got what he's talking here. This is the defense secretary. Rising sea levels, droughts, melting polar ice caps, devastating natural disasters. Aren't those security issues as well?
Possibly, but you don't address the problems of climate change and greenhouse gas emissions by producing and subsidizing a suboptimal market that in the end produces almost as much or in some cases more greenhouse gas emissions than petroleum-based fuels do. And of course, there have been enormous advancements in efficiencies and improvements in the way that that automobiles use fuel, thus reducing greenhouse gas emissions. There are ways to deal with the greenhouse gas emissions and other environmental consequences of petroleum burning fuels. But you don't solve that problem by creating a new industry with taxpayer dollars, profits going to private companies that in the end produce as much greenhouse gas emissions as the existing fuels that are much less costly and are not generally subsidized by the taxpayer.
I want to look at the politics here, but first, Phyllis, to this it's not a technicality, this issue of net emissions, Christopher's saying go to biofuels, and that's the biggest push here, and you don't get a net emissions savings.
That's actually not the case when you look at switchgrass, camelina, algae, and some of the other woody products that are actually going to be used in the creation of these biofuels. But I want to get back to something else that's been talked about, which is that there's a environmental cost and that there's, you know, this debate about national security, but also there's a debate about our economic security that we're not having in this conversation. We ship $300 billion a year out of our economy, and sure, would I rather have it go to Canada than Saudi Arabia? Of course. But it's $300 billion out of our economy.
To buy oil?
To buy oil when we could be investing it here at home, when we could be giving it to our farmers, creating whole new jobs and businesses here in the United States. Currently, the United States is a leader in the world when it comes to advanced biofuels. Why aren't we seizing on our own innovation and making these investments? I mean, this whole notion that it doesn't matter where we get our oil is not the kind of the right debate that we should be having. And furthermore, oil is a global commodity. Whether or not it comes from Canada or Mexico, the price is set on a global stage, which is largely controlled by OPEC. So we need to be clear that this is about not only our national security and our environmental security, but it's also about our economic security.
Let me go to Adam in Boston. Admiral, I'll come to you. Adam, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Pretty well. What do you see?
Thanks for taking my call. So I'm in the venture capital business, and I have no opinion about this particular flavor of biofuels, algae, switchgrass, corn ethanol whatsoever. Those will sort themselves out over the long haul. But I do have a very strong opinion about armed forces investments in R&D and commercialization technology. And over the past 100 years or so, I would say, just as a rump estimate, I would say 30 or 40% of the growth of GDP has come from technologies that were spawned by the Army, being the absolute perfect closed ecosystem for commercialization of technologies. The infrastructure that gets created, regardless of what the actual winning technology is, when he says starting markets, when the Admiral or whoever it was that was quoted talks about starting markets, what he's essentially saying is that the Army is the vanguard and a very thoughtful, long-term, clear-thinking, very analytically sound vanguard for saying these are spaces that we're going to do R&D or late-stage R&D and really commercialization, because these are things that are going to be important megatrends long term. We had it with microwaves, internet, electronics, data analytics, and now we're doing it in alternative fuels. And for Mr. Preble from the Cato Institute to take this narrow, short-term, market-as-God view that if you can't make a nickel off it today, then it's not worth, then it doesn't have any value, I think is intellectually dishonest to the point of being asinine. And I think anybody who understands history, anybody who really understands economics and the way markets form, the way technologies make their way into the world, has a very clear understanding of the role that the U.S. Armed Forces have played. The Army, the Navy, Navy Research Lab, all of these places, the proving ground, these are critical parts of our innovation infrastructure.
Indeed, and continue to be so on many fronts. Adam, our venture capitalist, I really appreciate your call. Admiral McGinn, you've been waiting patiently there. Help us here on a couple of fronts. I mean, you know, one, what about the long-term environmental issues here? You've got, Republican Senator Jim Inhofe going after Leon Panetta, who said those are an issue. And Senator Inhofe said, Senator Panetta has a real war to win, and he should not be wasting time perpetrating President Obama's global warming fantasies or his ongoing war on affordable energy. That's from the Oklahoma lawmaker. You know, what about that issue itself? And then what about the politics? Our caller Joby in San Francisco says this looks like, you know, big oil pushing back here again. Tom Friedman wrote a couple of years ago. He said, unlike the Congress, which can be bought off by big oil and big coal, it's not so easy to tell the Marines they can't buy solar power that could save lives or other. But maybe that's what's happening here, Dennis.
Admiral. Well, I think in the politics, we forget some of the fundamental science. The Earth is governed by physics, chemistry, and biology, not by politics. So no matter what Senator Inhofe or any of his colleagues say about what they'd like to believe is happening. We've got to listen to the people that know what they're talking about in terms of the overwhelming science. I'm talking more than 95% of the scientists in the United States, including the National Academy of Science, including people in the Department of Defense, CIA, and the list goes on. This is real. As Tom Friedman has also said, we've got to remember that Mother Nature always bats last, and she always bats 1,000. So no matter what policy outcomes we would like to have, we need to be mindful of the fact that these are physical phenomena that we have an ability to mitigate at least, and we need to make those investments for environmental security, for national security, for energy security, and as Phyllis Cutnow said, for economic security.
There's the physics and economics. What about the politics, Admiral McGinn?
I think the politics needs to really be based on the facts. If people are really honest and they're not trying to position themselves behind one party or the other, and they just look at the engineering and the science of these challenges and the economics, take a look at some of the reports coming out of the Congressional Research Service, the Congressional Budget Office, highly respected, very analytical, nonpartisan organizations, and what they are saying, the way is clear. We need to reduce our dependence on fossil fuel, and we need to do it in a way that really makes a difference, in this case, for our military's effectiveness. This isn't about greening the military. This is about making a more militarily effective force.
But part of that is, Ed, you heard Mavis and Panetta say it, part of it is encouraging a market, they say, for these fuels. I mean, do you see, you know what politics are, is this a big oil effort to kill them in the cradle by not getting the Pentagon behind them, or is that too much?
I can't really say with any authority on that. Certainly, there's always the power of the vested interest, and there are a lot of people that have a great stake in maintaining a business-as-usual approach. The Department of Defense is not one of them. They get paid, they're smart, they're dedicated, they're honest people who are trying to create the kinds of military capabilities that this nation's going to need, not just during this election cycle, but beyond the next decade.
Phyllis, we've just got 20 seconds here. In a word, do these bars, this ban on alternative fuels in effect stay in, or does it drop out before the budget's approved?
We hope it drops out, and I predicted it will.
Well, we will watch this space. Phyllis Cutnow with the Pew Project on National Security, Energy, and Climate. Thank you very much for being with us today. Christopher Preble at the Cato Institute, thank you. And Dennis McGinn, retired Navy Vice Admiral, now at the American Council on Renewable Energy, thanks to you all. In a moment, one high school teacher's blunt message for graduating seniors of 2012. This is On Point. David McCullough Jr., son of the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and an English teacher at Wellesley High School outside Boston, delivered an unorthodox commencement address to graduating seniors earlier this month. The message was blunt, an attack on an epidemic in America of heaping accolades ahead of genuine achievements. McCullough's message to the new high school grads, you are not special. It's getting buzz all over the web and national news. Here is some of that address.
Commencement is life's great ceremonial beginning, with its own attendant and highly appropriate symbolism. Fitting, for example, for this auspicious rite of passage is where we find ourselves this afternoon, the venue. Normally, I avoid cliches like the plague, wouldn't touch them with a 10-foot pole, but here we are on a literal level playing field. That matters. That says something. And your ceremonial costume, shapeless, uniform, one size fits all. Whether male or female, tall or short, scholar or slacker, spray-tanned prom queen or intergalactic Xbox assassin, each of you is dressed, you'll notice exactly the same. And your diploma, but for your name, exactly the same. All of this is as it should be because none of you is special. You're not special. You're not exceptional. Contrary to what your U9 soccer trophy suggests, your glowing seventh grade report card, despite every assurance of a certain corpulent purple dinosaur, that nice Mr. Rogers, and your batty Aunt Sylvia, No matter how often your paternal caped crusader has swooped in to save you, you are nothing special. Yes, you've been pampered, cosseted, doted upon, helmeted, bubble-wrapped. Yes, capable adults with other things to do have held you, kissed you, fed you, wiped your mouth, wiped your bottom, trained you, taught you, tutored you, coached you, listened to you, counseled you, encouraged you, consoled you, and encouraged you again. You've been nudged, cajoled, wheedled, and implored. You've been feted and fawned over and called sweetie pie. Yes, you have. And certainly we've been to your games, your plays, your recitals, your science fairs. Absolutely, smiles ignite when you walk into a room and hundreds gasp with delight at your every tweet. Why, maybe you've even had your picture in the Townsman. And now you've conquered high school. And indisputably here, we all have gathered for you, the pride and joy of this fine community, the first to emerge from that magnificent new building. But do not get the idea you're anything special, because you're not. But Dave, you cry. Walt Whitman tells me I'm my own version of perfect. Epictetus tells me I have the spark of Zeus. And I don't disagree. So that makes 6.8 billion examples of perfection, 6.8 billion sparks of Zeus. You see, if everyone is special, then no one is. If everyone gets a trophy, trophies become meaningless. In our unspoken but not so subtle Darwinian competition with one another, which springs, I think, from our fear of our own insignificance, a subset of our dread of mortality, we have of late, we Americans, to our detriment, come to love accolades more than genuine achievement. We have come to see them as the point, and we're happy to compromise standards or ignore reality if we suspect that's the quickest way, or only way, to have something to put on the mantelpiece, something to pose with, crow about, something with which to leverage ourselves into a better spot on the social totem pole. No longer is it how you play the game, no longer is it even whether you win or lose, or learn, or grow, or enjoy yourself doing it. Now it's, so what does this get me?
David McCullough Jr. speaking to graduating seniors at Wellesley High School in Wellesley, Massachusetts earlier this month. You are not special, he said. For a video and transcript of his address, go to our website, onpointradio.org. You can get news of upcoming shows. Hit the like button on Facebook for On Point Radio. It'll all be there for you. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.